Good evening. My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
What a group. My goodness. I want to welcome a few people. First of all, if you're a home group member, you come to this meeting every single week. Thank you for supporting AA and making AA what it is, which is a place for alcoholics who have nowhere else to go come to. And if you're someone who maybe 40 minutes ago was looking at their watch and thinking, you know, I don't think I really want to go to that meeting tonight, and something somewhere got you up off your couch or into your car or out of your office and drove you to this meeting, and you're here anyway, thank you. Because the people that do that are the ones that keep me coming back. And for the newcomers who just showed up, and you're probably wondering what the heck's going on here and what the heck have I gotten myself into, most of all, welcome to you, because the reason we come to these meetings is to welcome people like you into a world you have no idea the opportunities that exist for you. And I can tell you, as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been all three of those people. And there's been periods in my sobriety where I simply did not want to get up off the ground. I didn't want to come to the meetings, and yet I knew that this is where there was sanity and serenity for me. And so I'm so grateful. And what a meeting. My goodness, 150, 200 people here. I've heard about this meeting for the 8 years I've been in Tampa. And I have to say, I've never been here before. So thank you very much. Thank you, Monica, for inviting me. I'm really grateful to be here tonight. My sobriety date is July 17th, 2002. So for those of you that just got up and got chips, particularly on your anniversaries, congratulations. And also, you know, anybody, I grew up in the Northeast, and anybody who came in at the beginning of the summer was really finished. So congratulations on that. I was born in New Haven, Yale New Haven Hospital in New Haven, Connecticut, in 1961, and that's as close as I would get to Yale for about 27 years. And I'll tell you a little more about that later. But I was the fourth child in a family of five. I had three older siblings that were 6, 8, and 10 years older than me. I have a younger brother who's 7 years younger than me. So it felt like I was alone all the time. Amy, was it? Jessica, I'm sorry. What a wonderful talk she gave. And I got to tell you, there's nothing more difficult than giving a 10-minute talk or a 15-minute talk in AA, and that was just fantastic. I so related to what she had to say because I exhibited all of the behavior she talked about. I never felt like I was good enough, good-looking enough, smart enough. You know, I started wearing glasses when I was 4 years old, so, you know, you always walked into your any class you ever walked into, and they thought, oh, well, there's the Poindexter over there. Well, let me tell you, with a 2.1 grade point average coming out of college, there was no Poindexter coming out of me. So don't let it fool you. And in 1964, it wasn't very cool to wear glasses. So, you know, we can thank the 21st century for bringing glasses into style. But I've worn them for 40-some-odd years now. But for a while, I hid behind them. You know, they were just one more mask for me. And one of the things you might hear as you go around and listen to speakers of Alcoholics Anonymous is they always felt separated. They always felt isolated. They never felt anything was good enough, and that's the way it felt to me. I never felt like I had close enough friends. I never felt like I was doing enough in my family. I had a very loving family, but you know, we didn't have a whole lot of money, so I looked around and I would never have the right clothes on, and I wasn't driving a $50,000 car. I was driving a $600 Pinot, but to me it was still some level of freedom because I was able to get out of myself. I grew up in the Northeast, as I said, on Long Island for about 27 years, and I just had that feeling of never being connected. In roughly 1973, my sister got married, and as I said, we didn't have a whole lot of money, so we had the reception at our house. And we had 50 or 60 people over, and she was the first oldest in the family, and it was a big deal. You know, our family was big on family activities. And my father was a drinker. He loved drinking, and my mother drank when he drank, and that's just kind of the way my family was. So when we had this party, they had, like I said, 60, 70 people there, and I was all of 12 years old, and I'd never felt so separated. I was just completely this little kid in the corner type of thing, mostly adults. Well, we had a bartender came in who was a friend of the family to do the bartending, and my father was a big believer in lots of different types of booze, so we had, you know, rum and vodka and gin and everything and beer and wine and all kinds of things. And I guess the bartender thought, you know, Chris looks a little tight over there. Why don't we see if we can loosen him up a little bit? And so he put some rum in my Coke, and I, upon my asking, actually. So I had my first sip of alcohol at that party. And it was an afternoon party. And what I can tell you about that night was, as the party went on and the alcohol poured into me, I got friendlier and happier and all of these things that quite often you'll hear alcoholics share about what that first drink was like. A good friend of mine, John, shares, you know, he loves carrot cake, but he can't tell you when his first piece of carrot cake was. But most alcoholics can tell you when that first drink happened. And I think that's a testament to what alcohol does for us, because it totally changes the way I looked at the world. All of a sudden, I'm no longer this scared, not good enough kid. All of a sudden, I'm friendlier, I'm funnier, people want to talk to me, and life has changed completely. I continued to drink pretty heavily throughout the night, and as people were leaving, I was, you know, thanking everybody for coming and making it such a wonderful party, and I just remember that part of, oh my gosh, these people are leaving, now what am I going to do? And as they left, and the place emptied out, all of a sudden that moment of everything starting to go wrong started happening with alcohol in my system. And that night was miserable. I was very sick. You know, the whole bit, the bed spins. My family sort of, they just kind of put me up in a bed and kept an eye on me. And what I remember about the next morning was I woke up and my eyelids hurt. That's how bad I had a hangover. And I said to my mom, I said, Mom, my eyelids are broken or something. They're just, I don't know what's the matter. And they kind of chuckled because, you know, they knew exactly what had happened. And what I remember about that day literally was just this total, this transformation that occurred to me where all of a sudden I found where I could get comfortable. Was in a pretty competitive family. My brothers were pretty good athletes, and they were much older than me. And so that was sort of my next vein of what am I going to do next? And so I became an athlete. And I it's funny, I was a runner, but I hated running. So this will tell you a little bit about the alcoholic mind. I hated running, but I was pretty good at it. So I would get up and I'd run 6 miles before school every morning. And the way I got better at it was, is I didn't like it so much that all I did was run as absolutely hard as I could when I left until I got back, and it improved my ability to do it. But I was never the guy, you know, I was not a good running partner because I didn't have a pace. My pace was as fast as I could go without falling over. And again, this is sort of an indication of what my life would be like with alcohol. I continued through high school. We moved around quite a bit, although we moved, it was kind of odd. We moved within the same community. So I went to 2 different junior high schools. I went to 3 or 4 different elementary schools, and I went to 1 high school. But they all fed up into themselves. So I had this rotational activity of friends that weren't really friends. I knew them. They knew me. But I never really developed that wonder, you know, that group of friends. And that was another indication of the way my life was going to go in the not too distant future. We lived close enough to the high school where I walked to school, and we had an open campus, and both my parents worked, and so we had an open house during the day, and some of my friends from one of the junior high schools and friends from the other junior high school started figuring this out, and suddenly my house became the party house. So every lunchtime we would go back to my house, and there would be some sort of engaging in either liquor or drugs, and that was the way my high school went. So no surprise why 2.1 was what I was able to achieve. But I lived like 2 different lives, because that would be my midday, and then at 3 o'clock, sports practice would start, whichever one I was involved in, and I would be highly competitive during that period till about 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. And I did have one friend whose house I would go to pretty regularly. And then we would just party all night. And that was, you know, until 10 o'clock at night, and then I'd come home and crash. And that was basically the way my world was when I was in high school. I reached the point in life where high school was running out, you know, and when you get to the end of high school, you have to do something, and you either have to work, you have to go to school, and my family believed it would be important for me to go to school. So I wound up at the last minute getting enrolled at Syracuse University in Syracuse, New York. And we lived about 7 hours away from Syracuse. And my father had gone there before, my grandfather had gone there before. So there was this sort of semi-legacy thing going on, which I didn't really understand. But anyway, they deposited me at the dormitory of Syracuse University in 1979, the fall of 1979. And if you don't know, if you don't get set up for college until May, June, about this time of year, by the way, if you're not set up for college yet, pay attention, this is important. You wind up in sleeping in a lounge somewhere because they always have too many people come into school because so many people leave, and eventually they'll put you into a room. So I wound up dropped off at Syracuse University, 20-some-odd thousand people, and not anybody I know, and in a lounge in Syracuse, New York. And I had no idea why I was there. I had no clue what I was supposed to do. And it was just one of those other moments in my life where I had to figure out what to do next. And that was kind of the way I saw my life. I saw my life as, I have a problem, let me go solve the problem. I don't need to ask anybody, I better not tell anybody because they may find out about my problems. I sure as heck don't want to seem like an idiot that I have a problem. So I often and always just went and solved my own problems. And that's the way growing up was all about. When my parents left me in Syracuse, you'd mentioned you turned around and wanted to get out of there as quickly as possible. Well, 2 days later, I was hitchhiked 7 hours back to Long Island because I was so lonely. I just felt so lonely. I didn't know anybody. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. My roommates spoke probably three different languages, or they were from all over the place. One guy from Korea, he was crazy. He was pretty funny, but you couldn't understand a word he said, and he scared the heck out of me because he was ripped as all heck, and you know, he was just one of these wild guys. And I was not the wild guy that would go do the wild things without several hours of drinking ahead of time, and I didn't have a whole lot of money, so that wasn't really happening either. So anyway, that was just the way life was like. It was like this constant battle of, okay, what do I do next? So I was in Syracuse for a couple of weeks, and I finally got my schedule straightened out and figured out a way to pay for it, which, by the way, no one bothered to tell me that college was expensive. And that came into play later in life. But I wound up getting into classes and started getting into classes. They finally got me into a dorm room. And so things started to look like they were going to settle down. Well, again, I'm really uncomfortable there. I just don't feel like I fit in. I don't know anybody at all. I don't know how to meet people. That was another belief I had. I had no idea how to meet people. You know, I'd gone 18 years of my life and never had met anybody if you called inside my head and asked me. So I had all these kind of lies going on. Well, I walked past, I was in the cafeteria or whatever, and I saw one of those flyers up on the wall. And it had those famous two words that you see at college, rush night. And all of a sudden, and rush night for a certain fraternity house, and they had little shot glasses down on the corner of it, you know, come to Delta, 801 Walnut Avenue, have flaming shots of Jack Daniels. And I thought to myself, that sounds like fun. Flaming shots of Jack Daniels. I had no idea really what they were, but I knew about Jack Daniels. So I went to this rush party, and all of a sudden, again, I started doing shots. There was beer on tap all the time, and suddenly I felt looser. I felt more comfortable. I went back the next night. They had silver bullet shots or something. I went back the next night. It was kamikaze night. You know, I mean, it was just all of a sudden my life at Syracuse was starting to take shape. You know, this was now we were actually getting somewhere. This chemistry stuff, biology stuff, I mean, that's for the birds. But this drinking thing, this is readily available here, and I don't have to pay for it at this point. And the other thing was is that it introduced me to some people I could talk to. And when I was drunk, I could talk to people. I was comfortable. I was much more available. And so I wound up becoming a member of that fraternity. And the next 4 years of my life were pretty much wrapped around trying to figure out how often could we drink. And I worked two jobs at the time because I couldn't afford it there, which I didn't realize, but I had two jobs at the time. I was taking 12 credits or something. You know, I'm taking geography and, I don't know, geology. I mean, it was a really, really cutting-edge courses. And I'm drinking. But I got into college basketball. I get into college football. I'm now getting into the scene, you know. I'm actually living life. I'm realizing I'm almost an adult now. I'm away from home. I'm making my own money. I mean, all of these things were changing around me in my head. But the problem was is I was always looking for what's the next thing. Okay, now what? Now what? Now what? And to quench that insatiable desire for the next, as I call it, I didn't live in the now, I lived in the next, I drank. And drinking was basically, it put off everything. I didn't have to make decisions about anything when I drank. And I don't know why, and I'll share this. I don't know why, but I had this feeling that I wasn't going to live past 30. And there is no credible reason why I had that thought. But somewhere in my teens, I had it in my head, and I don't know if it was I read too much about Jim Morrison or Jimi Hendrix or Janis Joplin or something, but somewhere in my head, I got it in my head that I was not going to live past 30. And so I just figured, man, this is running out. We're at 17, 18 now. I got to pack this in. I got 12 more years here. And I mean, just had it in my head. I was dead at 30. That's all there was to it. There was nothing past 30. And so I constantly engaged in the lifestyle that I thought would take me further and farther and more intensity. And I did several crazy things during that time, including they were building the Carrier Dome. And they had one of those huge ladders that was, I don't know, 40 feet high, and it went up to one of the ribs. And I went up and had the first beer, I believe, in the Carrier Dome because I climbed up there after a fraternity party. And, you know, these were the kinds of things I was measuring my life by at this point. Most people were beginning to look at majors. I was looking at, can I get a Molson on the top deck of the Carrier Dome? You know, so this was what was important to me. You know, as you can see, life just sort of was spinning. And it wasn't really going anywhere. I actually reached a point in my fourth year. I took a year off. I worked to pay for a semester. I went home. I drank pretty much nonstop at that point. And I wound up in my fourth year of college. And all of my friends that I had come into the fraternity house with were graduating and getting ready to leave. And, you know, I had a degree. I was majoring in psychology, and there was no way I was going to, you know, test rats or anything like that. So that was really just a sort of a holding point. And I left school at the end of my fourth year, hadn't finished my degree, and I figured the answer to my problems was money. All I really needed to do was just go work hard because I was a hard worker, and I figured if I just worked hard, I could make money, and that would solve all my problems. And so I went back to Long Island, moved in with my parents, and bought the $600 Pinto, and became involved in the restaurant business. And if you know anything about the restaurant business, it's a great business. You don't see a lot of people over 40 in the restaurant business. It's not a business that you last a long time in. The people that are over 40, I shouldn't say that as a blanket statement, but people that are over 40 have figured out how not to do what I did in the 5 years I worked in the restaurant business, which was pretty much a nonstop party. We had a restaurant, but we also had a disco bar that stayed open until 4 o'clock in the morning because that was the drinking time in Long Island. And for me, it was just party on. And I had it in my head that I threw a party for 1,000 people every night. The odd thing was I watched it all from the outside. I never participated in it. I always felt like I was there, but I was just there. I was never engaged with anybody. People used to say to me, you're in the restaurant business. You must have a wonderful social life. I had had one girlfriend at this point in my life. You know, it was just not part of my behavior to be engaged with other people. So that continued for about 5 years, and things got a little out of hand. I wound up getting out of that business. I was a manager And I decided that was enough. I was going to go see the world, because after all, I was beginning to run out of time. We were down to 5 years now. I only had 5 more years to live. And so I decided that a friend of mine who had worked in the business with me had worked down at the Everglades Club down in Palm Beach. They have a seasonal deal where they're there from November to May. And you can go down, and pretty much they put you up on Worth Avenue. They pay you about $100 a week, but it's a piece of cake job. I could body surf every day. I could live in Florida, which is something I'd always wanted to do. And I decided this was the start for me, and after that I'd figure out where to go next. So I went down to the Everglades Club, and I got the job. And inside of 2 months, things had completely spiraled out of control. And in March of 1988, I was arrested for a non-alcoholic related activity, and all of a sudden my life just kind of opened up to me. My family kind of found out what was going on in my world, and I spent 10 days in the lovely Indian Town Jail, which I found out one of my our other brothers here also spent the same time I was there. He was in the same jail, so who would have thought that? I ran into him about 6 months ago at a meeting here in Tampa, and life was just out of control, and I wound up getting shipped back up. My father at this point had died. He actually, he was an alcoholic and drank alcoholically for his entire life. And one night he'd come home from a party and he got out of the car and he just keeled over. And, on his birth certificate he said he died from alcohol poisoning. And I love my father dearly. He was a wonderful man and did the best he could with what he could. But he was I look back on it. At the time, I was very resentful and angry about a lot of things that he hadn't taught me about and hadn't shown me. And, why did I only have one girlfriend, Dad? What's the matter with you? Type of thing. And it was just ridiculous. And so my dad had passed away, and my poor mother, who was, working as basically a secretary in one of the Hartford insurance companies, was trying to support these kind of three kids that were still hanging around. The other two actually got their act together, moved out of the house, got married, and had real lives. And I show up on her front door and, just kind of a mess at 27. And, my mom, obviously, open arms brought me in. But there were problems, right? Things were not going well. So I wound up going to a treatment, an outsourced treatment program that Connecticut had, because I had lapsed on back then you tried to get into these 28-day deals because they were really pretty cushy and you could go off for 28 days and your insurance would cover it. And I had screwed up my COBRA coverage, so I didn't have insurance. So for a week I tried to talk them into the fact that, no, it was just a little mistake on not paying that bill and they really ought to give me my insurance, and they knew what was going on. So I wound up having to go to a county or state-run program that Connecticut had to help people with alcohol and drugs. And I went down there. It was in the same hospital I was born in Yale New Haven Hospital. And I had to drive an hour and 20 minutes every Wednesday to go to that meeting. And it was a one-hour session with about 9 or 10 other people that had alcohol and drug problems. And when I went in there, they asked me, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I said, well, no, not really. I mean, I drink and all, but, I'm 27, so, why wouldn't you drink at 27? They said to me, well, why don't you just, this is a suggestion. This is a six-month program. They said, let us know how next week, but why don't you try not to drink during this time? And I said, okay, no problem. I don't really have that big a problem with alcohol. Now, what I didn't tell you is there was a point during my restaurant career where at 5 a.m. in the morning, I can remember on several occasions, looking over at the line of liquor in the liquor draw and going, I can't remember the last day I went 24 hours without a drink. And my parents used to have that argument. My mom used to say, when was the last time you went 24 hours without a drink? And my father would do this big grandiose thing. And I remember that from growing up. And I remember that in my head going, when was the last time I went 24 hours without a drink? And I couldn't remember. But I didn't think I had an alcohol problem, because I had been caught, although I'd been caught 3 times for DUI, they let me go every time. They let me sit on the side of the road, and they didn't take me in. I didn't get the impact. So if you've been caught for that and put in jail and you still have a resentment over that, come talk to me. I'll tell you, that might have been the best thing that ever happened to you. You never know. But I So I agreed. I'm like, sure, no problem. 6 months, no drinking. I agree. Life's out of control. We need to change everything. And I'll listen to y'all. So I did. I went, and actually it was a useful program. They said, why don't you go try out one of these 12-step groups? And I did. And boy, it was about a meeting this large, and I was petrified. I sat against that back wall, and I went once, and then I didn't. But I could go to my therapy sessions that had 8 to 10 alcoholics at it. So I did that for 6 months, and I didn't drink. And I got out of that. I did get introduced to AA, though. They showed me what the big book was about, and they showed me what a 12 and 12 was about. And I took those books home with me, and I put them promptly on the countertop, and I never looked at them. About a year and a half went by, and I had decided I was going to start some controlled drinking because let's really see what the deal is with this drinking. Now, mind you, I had not talked to one person about this. I had not asked anybody about this. My brothers and sisters were kind of curious, but, you know, our family was, don't need to talk about it if it's not involved jail time. My jail time got a lot of attention in my family, by the way, but not much else did. And so I just slowly started creeping into, let me just drink on the weekends. Let me not drink when I drive. I used to always drink when I drive. I had a cooler in the back of the Pinto. It always was full of beer. And that was the way life was. And all of a sudden, you know what happened. Snowball starts happening, and all of a sudden, I'm a full raging alcoholic. I'm drinking every single day, and I'm drinking to excess. And I got pulled over on January 1st, 1990, after watching a whole bunch of football games and my brother dropping him off at his apartment in Hartford, driving through the worst part of town at about 50 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone, running a couple of lights. And the officer saw me do it, pulled me over, asked me if I'd been drinking, said, just a little. And I remember him going, okay, well, let me go check you out. He took my license registration. And I remember I had that moment with God where I said, God, get me out of this. I said, if you get me out of this, I will never drink again. And I don't know that that prayer always works. I have heard it doesn't work an awful lot. But I knew I was desperate. I will say that. What I did get in that moment was this feeling of, oh, my God, I cannot control this. And I went home, and it did. The cop came back. He gave me a license. He gave me a warning. I don't know. I guess you get a warning for running two red lights in the worst part of town on January 1st in Hartford, Connecticut. And I went home, and I had one beer left in the refrigerator. So, you know, you would think after all of that, maybe I'd throw it out. Oh, no. I'm an alcoholic. I drank the last beer. I drank that last beer, and I just knew that all of the conversations I had made me very clear that I was an alcoholic and I couldn't control this. I walked into the rooms of AA 14 days later, and I was terrified. I walked into a dark room. I saw a bunch of people I just backed out. And for the next 12 years, I was in and out of the rooms of AA. And I was, what happened was, is I basically became a workaholic, and I became completely obsessed with my job. And where I was going to go next. And I, some reason that dying at 30 thing went away because I was about 29 and a half and I needed to let that one go. So I went all over the country and I did all these things I thought I needed to do. And I stayed away from AA. And I would show up every so often. Now in that time I had a marriage and a divorce that happened in 2 years. And when that divorce happened, it was the biggest shock in my life. Marriage probably was too, as I look back on it. But when I went to get some help about that, and they said, I talked about my alcoholism and all my challenges in the past, and identify myself as an alcoholic, and they said, why don't you try that AA thing again? So I did. I went to AA. I was in Dallas, Texas. I spent the next 6 months in AA. For the first time in my life, I got a sponsor, but I was one of these guys that never listened to what the sponsor had to say. And, I would take a couple of ideas, but not the full idea. And so soon enough, I was back out of AA again. And I did that for the better part of 12 years. And in 2002, roughly June-July time period, I had accomplished everything I needed to accomplish. I had a good job. I had a good money. I had a good car. I had a girlfriend. I thought I had gotten everything I needed to have, and I could not sleep at night. I'd try to go to bed at night, and I just couldn't sleep at night. My life was miserable. I was completely and utterly unhappy. I had gotten some information about some AA meetings here in Tampa, and I'll keep this short because I'm almost done with my time, but I had gotten some tapes of a person who spoke out of Wilmington, North Carolina, and if you ever, the tapers are unbelievable because the taper will put their name and their number at the bottom of that tape, and I got in this tape, and for the first time ever, I identified with an alcoholic. I listened to this tape, and everything suddenly flooded in and made sense. But I was still in that fear mode where I could not go to a meeting. I couldn't reach out. I got so desperate enough, I broke down on the side of the road crying between Orlando and Tampa on I-4, and I reached for that tape, and I looked at it, and there was George's number. He lived in Louisville, Texas, and I called him up, and I said, George, can you put me in touch with Keith, who was the speaker on the tape? He did. I got a chance to talk to Keith. Keith said, where do you live? I said, Tampa, Florida. He said, Tampa. He goes, well, my old sponsor lives down in Tampa. Why don't you go try to go to a meeting? I'm sure somebody will know who he is. His name's Sandy B. I said, okay, let me go to a meeting. So Sandy B. lived 2 miles away from my house. I wound up July 17th, 2002, walking into the rooms of the Bayshore Presbyterian Church, the Wednesday night meeting, the Riverside Group. And at that time, there were about 12 other people there. I know now it gets about 30 to 40 to 50 to 60 people, depending on the night. But it was a good group of drunks, and I said to them, I'm an alcoholic, and I need some help. And for the first time, I really meant it. And I talked to somebody in that meeting afterwards, which is the first time I'd ever done that, because if you're kind of in and out of this thing, you don't hang around to talk to people about it, right? So, because they'll ask you how many meetings you go to, and that's a horrible question to ask any alcoholic who doesn't want to be here. So I walked outside and I asked the person that heard that I had asked for help, and he said, Chris, what can I do for you? I said, I don't know. I said, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this. Everything I have tried has failed, and I can't stand it any longer. And they said, well, how many meetings do you go to? And I was like, oh God. I said, well, this is my first. And and he said, look, you know, I've been here 7 years, and I can't just do one meeting a week. And then I said, yeah, sometimes I was going once a week, sometimes once a month, sometimes I get busy. And they said, he said, Chris, I said, I why don't you try? This is almost the same verbatim thing somebody had told me 14 years earlier. But my mind had gotten to that point where it was open. And I don't know if you're new in here and your mind's open yet. I can't tell you whether it is or it isn't. But I had gotten to that point where my mind was open, and somebody made a suggestion. And he said, why don't you try more than a couple of meetings a week? Do you think you can do that? And I had that magical activity that happens in many of our lives where at the back of my head, with a voice I had never heard before or never said, I said, okay. And I don't know why, but this wave came over me, and I knew I meant it. And for the next 8 months, I went to AA hating every minute of it. But I did it anyway. I was the guy that waited till the last few minutes to get off the couch. And when I came in, I asked people, what do I do? And I actually followed their direction. They said, get a sponsor. I said, I'll get a sponsor. I found a sponsor. He kind of disappeared. I wound up with another sponsor. I tried to stay with that one. So I wound up with a wonderful guy who's helped me in my program in the last 8 years. And he walked me through the steps. But he made me kind of beg. And I was at that point of begging. I said, guy, I have got to go through these steps. He said, okay, now you're ready. And for me, that's the way it worked. I don't know how it works for y'all, but for me, I needed to reach that point where I was willing to listen to anything you had to say. Somebody told me to get a service position, I got service positions. Somebody told me, why don't you go talk to a newcomer? I went and talked to a newcomer. Somebody said, why don't you stop sharing? I stopped sharing. You know, there reaches that point in AA where all of a sudden, when you're listening to someone else, you're not waiting to talk. And when I was in that fraternity house, and when I was in that high school, and when I was in my family growing up, all I ever did was kind of wait to talk or wait to get out of the conversation. I was not participating. And suddenly in AA, I found myself starting to participate. They said, why don't you go to dinner afterwards? I was like, oh, there won't be a chair there. I'll walk in. It'll be late. This is going to be awful. It's going to be so awkward and embarrassing. I was all about awkward and embarrassing. I walked in, and there it was. There's the chair, you know. And you know what? Even if there's not one there, they'll make one, you know. They really will. So I started going to the dinner after the meetings, and suddenly AA became my community. And I got walked through the steps, which to me is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I make one of my meetings a week, at least a step meeting, and I think it's really important to stay in the steps. To me, if I didn't work the steps those 12 years. I mean, so I started my sobriety date over again. for me, it's just a good starting point. I'm not that interested really in the longevity of how long it's been since I've had a drink. I've been sober since July 17, 2002. I've been a sober member of Alcoholics since July 17, 2002, and I've been a participant in Alcoholics Anonymous since July 17, 2002. And you guys welcomed me here, and I couldn't have done it without you because you taught me about a God I had no interest in knowing, but I had a desperate need to know. And you showed me what that was like, and you made it okay that I didn't have to go to church right away, and I didn't have to know Jesus, and I didn't have to know Buddha, and I didn't have to know all these things about religion. And you taught me about all of that. You taught me how to easily get in the door. And now I have a God that is very clear to me and very understanding. But I still ask for help. I ask for help all the time with any major decision I have. And anytime I'm disturbed, I ask somebody in my alcoholic circle of friends, what do you think about this? I'm really upset about this. I need some time. Can I run something past you? And I've never had anyone say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not that interested in your problem today, you know? And that's how we do it. We reach out to others and we get out of ourselves. I want to thank you so much for having me tonight. What a wonderful meeting, and I really look forward to coming back as a participant. Thanks very much.
I am Blair, I'm an alcoholic. Dr. Bob's last message delivered at the first International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flash into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into words, love and service. We understand what love is and we understand what service is, so let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us, to our less fortunate brothers. Thank you very much.